into modern times. So that's what I kind of felt like, at least on the sheets I gave you. I'd like to tell you what is the high points if you want to do reading. Yes? I might. Let's see. I think I threw that folder in here. If you guys will all talk among yourselves rather than stare at me, I think I can find them. Yes, they are here.
And they're separated by the yellow.
So I think we start with number 32. And to be quite honest, this last area about the impact of the New Deal on the union movement is one that I have believed over the years that I'm not good at, and so I've studied more and more and more, and still it reinforces my belief that I'm not good at it, and that's probably one of the reasons we stopped early last time, because I thought, oh no, the labor movement, give me some chance to get some courage up. And so here are the things that I think are critical and that will be tested over. It's, first, there is a growth that takes place, thank you, in the AFL. And what do we recall about the American Federation of Labor? Right after the death of the Knights of Labor in 1886, they formed in that time period. Samuel Gompers was the founding president. That's very important. They supported World War I, and therefore, when other unions were driven out of existence for being too radical in the teens and 20s, they earned the reputation of being a patriotic, loyal, pro-capitalist union. In fact, Gompers often said he didn't mind employers making more profit than the workers as long as the workers got their fair share for their work. And so he was the kind of union leader that America could handle without feeling too estranged by it. Also, the AFL was a union that only recruited skilled workers rather than unskilled workers. So that's automatically going to make it different from most unions of the time period in the sense they're upper-class income earners. They're going to be probably more WASP, less immigrant members. They'll have a lot more effective power with strikes and boycotts because it's hard to replace skilled workers. And so they will focus on those direct action tactics as opposed to turning to utopian politics. And this is the significant thing about the AFL, that they were not politically minded, or they didn't expect political results at all from the national level. And only in limited cases did they go after state governments to try to get better conditions through voting booth. So usually it was like, through strikes and boycotts, that they could achieve their gains. Well, what we talked about in item 28, the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, that movement, that organization or government agency, was created with the sole purpose of protecting unions from business abuse. And this is a historic reverse from the traditional position that government held, where government tended to trust the businesses over the workers, automatically assume that strikes and violence were the faults of the workers. But when they mobilized with troops, it was always on the side of protecting property against strikers. So this is a real sea change politically for America to see that the national government embraces and protects unions. But then again, a lot of this has to do with its protecting the AFL. And as I started off to say, within the American Federation of Labor by the 1930s, there had grown a large, almost 40% of the membership were not really skilled workers. They were in a section called the Committee of Industrial Organizations, which organized by industry rather than by specific skill. And of course, the reason they're welcomed in is because there are so many and they're powerful. There's strength in large numbers, bargaining power. But the Committee of Industrial Organizations, being 40% of the organization, felt they should have somewhere close to 40% of the vote in policy making. which they didn't. And so between 35 and 36, and really happening mainly in 36, there is a split, a schism that takes place that is in item 32 here. And the CIO splits away from the AF of L, renames itself the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And these two unions will compete for being the nationally recognized unions for a good 20 years, until 1955, when they re-merge to the current AFL-CIO. The Congress of Industrial Organizations. The leader of the CIO is John L. Lewis, who we've talked about before in this testing period. Do you recall? If you see him, he had in picture his big, thick eyebrows like Michael Dukakis did, if you remember that. Gruff-looking face, lots of times, a lot of dust on his face and a hat, miner's hat. He was the one that was the leader of the United Mine Workers in the 1919 strike we talked about. So he had grew from that position to become the CIO president. And it is the CIO that is the more militant union trying to organize the industries in the 1930s, while the AF-AVL is kind of more of a backseat, take it cautious union. In 33 and 34, these are the two industries that were under attack or under target for unionization: the auto industry and the steel industry. And there were numerous strikes that occur in Michigan, the one in Flint, Michigan, which involved a sit-down strike that was responded to with high-power hoses and again, the use of Pinkertons, resulted in the industry caving in. And this, instead of it being that the strike falls apart and the workers lose, the solidarity and the strength, and definitely the public opinion, was on the side of the strikers. Now, when FDR observed what happened in the Flint, Michigan strike, he was disgusted by the fact that property and lives and everything was in danger for so many days, but he made it clear that he felt the workers had the argument over the owners. And when the businesses, the auto industry, could see that the President of the United States is not taking their side but is sympathetic and eventually could mobilize to protect workers, they caved and recognized the CIO in the auto industry. Big Steel did the same thing, Big Steel being U.S. Steel. Smaller steel companies like Republic Steel, however, held out, and there was a violent struggle that occurred in those, in that company, the Republic Steel Company. But in time, it caved also. So what couldn't be done in 1894 through the Pullman strike, we recall this, where that strike fell apart and union recognition never came to be, finally comes to be in 1937. So that's what is the salient features of the union movement in the mid-30s: is it gains federal support, it gains FDR's support. There is the National Labor Relations Board, which is watching over when business abuses workers. And why would, aside from the fact that, and I hate to be cynical here, but aside from the fact that FDR was sympathetic to the workers, why did he take a pro-union position over business? Votes, it's the voters. It's the tilt of the Second New Deal for sure, but it is also, since the 1936 election we talked about, clear that the New Deal coalition is firmly built on union participation. So union support is going to be critical for the 1936 and 1940 and all the elections on up until recent times. And big business owners are not going to be able to deliver the votes that the union membership can. In item 35, FDR tries something which he thinks will show that the Depression has been defeated. He cuts back, through executive order, he cuts back on the spending of various relief agencies and recovery programs. And immediately a recession occurs, right? So recession within the Depression. And seeing this and not wanting to suffer retribution in the midterm elections of 38, he orders the spending to be increased. So that's where historians look back and say, if when he tries to pull back the artificial pump priming going on, we start to slip right back into the Depression, there is some evidence to be given to the side of the free market capitalists that argue that instead of defeating the Depression, all he's done is delayed it. Now, when do we usually interpret the Depression of being defeated? World War II. Yeah, World War II spending. Even before we're in. By 1940 and early 41, when we're building weapons and going back down that same trail of giving weapons to the victims of Germany, there's so many jobs available, we have to import labor from Mexico, and it's a case of where high unemployment and economic health has returned. But if you think about it, if we say that World War II spending is what resolved the Depression, how does that really differ from artificial social program spending? Because it's outside of everything. I guess that's true. That's true. I think that the major explanation that I like to use, since I'm biased, is that, to be honest about it, is we spent about $40 billion to fight the Depression through the New Deal. We spent $400 billion to fight World War II. So it's 10 times as much spending. So left-leaning me and my ilk will say that if we had spent four times as much in 1933, 34, and 35, we could have whipped the Depression in the first year or two. It was those who were opposed to the New Deal that slowed down the recovery. Well, people sometimes start to think, well, let's if artificial spending is not the cure but only the temporary delay, then why didn't, when World War II was over, why didn't we fall right back into a depression? But if the economy was being floated along through government spending, why didn't it crash? Why didn't things go right back to... If the 37 recession shows that cutting back on spending let things fall back to a bad natural state... Okay, there was, you could say that the programs and the reforms that were put into place now are more effective and have stayed more effective. I think that's definitely true. It could well be that actually a certain degree of real market health was finally generated during the World War II activity.
Isn't there a population explosion
right after the war? There you go. These are the factors. The baby, my generation, the baby boom generation that comes from 45 through 60, there's just a lot more people who can become workers and consumers. And there's a place for them all, but also there's some good planning that takes place. Like my father was not mustered out of the Navy. He fought in Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and he was not mustered out of the Navy until 1947. And others we know on the GI Bill went to college until the early 50s. So there was some real planning put into place to say we'll bring these people out as the economy can absorb them. And the keeping up of a standing military had a couple of reasons also to adjust how many people are in the workforce, but also to face the Soviet threat. So good planning, good luck probably is the best explanation for that. A few leftover things here in 1938 to mention in item 36. There is a second Agricultural Adjustment Act passed. This time it was not funded by a processing fee on millers and grocers, etc. This time it came directly out of the tax till, so it didn't suffer the fight of unconstitutionality. The court gave it in the Butler case, 1935. This is the act, I think we've already mentioned this already, that dealt with the Dust Bowl conditions of trying to do contour plowing, legume replanting nutrients, etc. Those things we mentioned earlier to fight soil erosion were all put into the second AAA. The first minimum wage nationally, not state, but nationally, is passed in the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, establishing a 25 cents an hour minimum wage, which by the 1940s went to a 40 cents an hour wage. And if you get on the computer and look at like index inflation generators where you can kind of see how much money was worth in each year and how much a house cost, that actually wasn't so bad. That the 25 cents an hour and the 40 cents an hour were better than the $1.60 an hour in the 1960s at the minimum wage I worked at, and is better than the minimum wage of now in regards to the cost of housing and gasoline, especially gasoline. Well, 1938 midterm elections come about. One other thing about the Fair Labor Standards Act, it also included a national ban on products made by children under age 16. So what had been state laws, in which had been an attempted amendment to the Constitution but never passed, finally becomes a national law through the Fair Labor Standards Act. In 1938, Southern Democrats, who had never been really gaga over the New Deal, Southern Democrats were always far more conservative. They were uncomfortable with big spending programs. They didn't like the debts and deficit spending. As more and more Republicans were being elected in 36 through 38, Southern Democrats, called boll weevils because they're considered kind of not cooperative with Northern liberals, boll weevils and the gypsy moth Republicans, as they were called, banded together to block further New Deal programs. So effectively, after the court packing plan fails, by 1938, getting more, at least far left-leaning liberal programs to Congress is quite difficult. So FDR believes there's a way to discipline these Southern Democrats. He will go down and visit and tell each one, if you're not on board with the New Deal, I will support someone else in the primary elections and unseat you. So different Democrats will get your seat in 1938.
So the Bellwiggles were the Southern?
Southern Democrats that were too conservative for FDR. And he threatens these people that unless you come over and side with me, we're going to run candidates against you in your primary elections. And every one of them in the South said, try it. You know, our voters vote for me, not you. So he tried it. He tried to give his support to new candidates, and they lost every election. So therefore, the Bo Weevils now became even more emboldened with Republicans to oppose New Deal programs. And politically for FDR, he just moves away from the New Deal and starts focusing on World War II, which allows him to win the 40 election. So 39 is the last item on the sheet we need to worry about. Those other things are on there for the AP classes at the high school. They're interesting, but we can stop at 39. Pluses and minuses of the New Deal. I'll look an overview of it. I always like to start with the criticism first, so the memory that we end with is the positive, hopefully. Critics of the New Deal argued that for the first time the U.S. government embarked upon a program that it's never been able to get away from, and that is deficit spending. And that the compounding debt that has followed is a direct result of leaving sound market principles. Another criticism of the New Deal is that it started the destruction of initiative. That prior to the New Deal, people realized that their livelihood was based on their own efforts, and it made people more industrious and had personal initiative. And that with the beginning of government programs to bail people out, there is a less productive society. The third criticism is the growth of both the presidency, but also all the federal government. And this is something that probably resonates back to the beginning of the country, the fear of large central federal government. That's what was at the heart of the Articles of Confederation. Even the rebuilding of the Constitution was still built around great limitations on federal power. So what was looked at as a temporary solution was going to be later seen as a permanent deviation from the original intent of the framers. I think that's all the criticisms I can think of. If anybody has more, feel free to bring them up. I mean, really, if you take today's conservative liberal argument about big government programs, they're still pretty much the same arguments. Attack on private property. Primarily, it's the too much big government invasion of liberty viewpoint. Sometimes it's hard to think of the positives, too, when I try to go through that. I think the one that impresses me the most, though, is for the first time our government said we're not going to let people starve. There's going to be a social safety net below which people do not fall. That somebody is going to take responsibility, and it should be the government, for emergency situations. Now, something that was not intended but was a consequence was the creation of a consumer middle class. All this redistribution of wealth, it was just a cope for the Depression, but it finally created something that had not existed in modern capitalist America, and that was a consumer middle class that even in hard times still has savings and is making real income and thus are buying durable goods, and that keeps those industries afloat. Reform measures. Things like FDIC and the Securities Exchange Commission, the things that you pointed out, kept the Depression from coming back in the 40s and 50s is a plus positive in the New Deal. But one other thing which I think was not intended at the start, but by the time they got into the second New Deal, FDR began to say there are pockets of poverty, there are fundamental weaknesses in our nation's economy that existed before the Depression. It wasn't just in 1929 that these things existed. These are problems especially for farmers, people in the Tennessee Valley area, the Appalachia area, who had always been without electricity, without manageable flood control, that these are things that should have been fixed long ago, even without a depression. So take advantage of the opportunity to do that. So I think there's some pluses there with the New Deal. Well, that gets us through what you'll be tested over. If you have any interest on these other sheets that we handed out, give you a quick summary of what's happening here. About the first four sheets or more, maybe even Five sheets. Yeah, about the first five sheets are pre-Pearl Harbor. And it's the area I find most interesting in history, and I wish I had a chance to cover it, and that is how, and you're familiar with this start, and that is how after the Versailles Treaty, America lurched back into a more isolationist retrenchment period. And in the 20s and 30s, we were, as a nation, very, very guarded against getting back into a second war. We passed laws called Neutrality Acts in the 30s to make it illegal to sell weapons to countries at war, to lend money, to travel on those ships. And there is all the way up until the days before Pearl Harbor a strong isolationist stay-out-of-war movement. And it's Pearl Harbor that shocks us into World War II and really is a permanent vector out of isolationism. So that's a lot of what these sheets are about. And I think I gave you up to write the dropping of the atomic bomb and the ending of the war. So if you want to use these as reading guides with your textbook, it's interesting stuff. So you ready for the numbers on what's on your exam, though? On page one, which starts off saying U.S. history 1914 to 1939, World War I, etc., up there. If your number four is Archduke Franz Ferdinand, we're on the same page. It is? Okay, number four. Number six. And I thought about telling you which of that is on the test, but just for to be mean, I'll leave it number six. If you know how things start, you're okay. Six, nine, 10, 12, and 13. Next page, 16, 17, 19, 21, and 24. Next page, 28, 33, 35, and 36.
Which
33? Okay, let's see. The 33 that has all those aspects of the Versailles Treaty, Rhineland demilitarized down through League of Nations salvaged. Especially League of Nations salvaged. Next page, 39. And then the numbers start over again with and circle 4. So 39 jumping to 4. 6, 7, 9, and 10. And there is one or two questions on the test where there's no number to circle. But the essence of it is, what was the major focus and concerns of the Harding-Coolidge administration in regards to business? And it's keep government out. Promote business growth, free of government interference. The business of America's business, quote. That captures a lot of what that question will ask. Next page, where number 12 is Hoover, don't circle 12, but I want to make sure we're on the same page. Next page, 19, immigration restrictions, 20, 21, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, and that shows you something right there. When I'm slamming the 20s for being right wing, I'm putting every one of them on the test there. Next page, where the 1930s Depression New Deal starts, 1, A through C, 5, 6, 8, and 9. Next page, number 10, the fireside chats at the top, 12, 14, 16, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22.
Did you say number 10?
I did say 10, yes. 10, 12, 14, 16, then 18 through 22, and 24. Again, when it tilts to the left, I'm all over it. I'm into it. Then last page, 28, 29, 30, and 31. And 38, because there will be a question about which of the following was or was not a criticism of the New Deal or a praise, etc. So that finished, and your exam's not comprehensive, it's just these sheets, the numbers that were circled, like a normal test. So A, you're free to go now if you want to. B, if you want to stay and talk about any of these things on the test or anything in life, I'm here. Like normal. Yeah. In fact, I think it's set at 6:30, so I'm finally going to be on time. Rather than 5:30. Rather than 5:25. the final on Thursday. We don't come Tuesday, right?
Okay. Yeah, next Thursday.
Yeah, so it's a week from tonight, and you don't come Tuesday. Yes.
5:30 or 6:30?
Sorry, 5:30. My mistake. Yes. Like normal.
Question. Can we look at my grades?
Yeah, I'm
going to
opt out of the panel.
You just want to make sure you're safe?
Yeah, I want to make sure. This is all the same.